Welcome, everyone, to our Kollel Aharon V'Leia. And tonight, we are celebrating the upcoming holiday, the festival of Purim. And we're going to begin tonight with our first of a series of classes in the Book of Esther. So what I'd like to do is start just at the beginning of Genesis, very quickly, in a cute way. And then we're going to talk about some of the main characters, mainly the villain, because usually villains are villainous, and if they're good villains, if they're like the Hannibal Lecter, you know, Emperor Palpatine, Darth Vader mode, they really do dominate and make the protagonist that much more interesting. So let's talk about the first appearance of Haman. Ooh, yes. So Haman makes his first appearance, according to the Talmud in Chulin. Do you know where? In the Garden of Eden. Gomorrah asks in Chulin, Haman mina Torah minayin. Where do you know Haman as like an illusion in the Torah for the first time? He's in the Garden of Eden. Why? God says to Adam and Eve, Hamin ha'etz, Hamin. So hey, mem, nun. Did you all eat from that tree of knowledge that I told you not to eat from? So that apparently is Haman. That's a reference, a veiled reference, very veiled, to Haman, to Haman. Now, before you say, well, that's kind of cute, what does that mean? It just simply means that woven into the fabric of creation itself, into nature, is the potentiality for this nation that we know as Amalek. Amalek. And we know that Amalek, in Jewish numerology, equals the word safek, doubt, a shadow of doubt. And Amalek always rears his ugly head in Jewish history, whenever there is a safek, a doubt, perhaps klapei hashchina, the Jewish perspective of how we see God. So for example, we leave Egypt, come to Rephidim, and we're very thirsty at Rephidim, so we complain, and we force Moses, Moshe hits the rock to bring out the water. That's okay for him to do it at that moment, that's okay. And what happens at Rephidim, the people, and this was not okay, they asked, Hayesh Hashem b'kibeinu imayim. Where's God? Is he in our midst or not? And Amalek was the answer. Meaning, if you have to ask where I am, I'm going to introduce you to Amalek, and his nefarious activities are going to elicit a response, God, please help us from Amalek. And that's the first time he rises up in the Torah conversation. However, and this is going to get cutesy, but I hope profound. Are you ready? Haman also appears, and this is not from a Talmud, this is from my Rebbe, my teacher. Haman appears in Parshat Bishalach, just 2 weeks ago. Bishalach. The Jewish people come to the desert, they're thirsty, they kvetch, and then they're hungry. They kvetch again. And what did God give them? Food from heaven. And what was that food called? Man. They gave him Haman, the man, the manna. Wow. Okay. Before it's just cute, let's get a little more profound, shall we? Yeah. What is man as a definition by Rashi? What does the word man mean? The people saw this weird substance that appeared magically in the morning on a beautiful little layer of dew above and below. It was prepared food. They didn't know what it was. So they basically said, what is this? Manhu. What is it? So Rashi famously says, it is hachanat mazon. It's a form of prepared, ready-to-eat food. Wow. And if you didn't want to bake it or cook it or make it like tofu into any dish you wish, you could eat it just as is. And it had a beautiful flavor. It tasted like dough fried in honey. I mean, who wouldn't want calorie-free? Because it was. It didn't get digested the way normal food would. So who wouldn't want, like, you know, Krispy Kreme donuts, unlimited? And if you wanted it not to taste like Krispy Kreme and you were a righteous individual, you could imagine, you know, I don't know, Sarah's delicious baked spaghetti pasta dish, and it would magically taste like that. Or as one of the little girls asked me, Rabbi, what if you imagined it tasting like a Big Mac? I said to the little girl who was in fourth grade, I said, Dvorah, that's a great question, but how would you imagine what a Big Mac would taste like unless you had one, right, Dvorah? So that was the end of that interesting little discussion for little Dvorah. Hope she wasn't, you know, scarred for life. But it was kind of a cute question and maybe even a cuter answer. So, man, this magical food from heaven, was prepared food. But it's more than that. The source for why we as Jewish people are not allowed to prepare food on our holy Sabbath, Shabbos, is sourced in man. Friday morning, we're told, it fell double. One for Friday's food, one for Shabbat's food, which is one of the main sources why we have Lechem Mishnah, why we have the two challahs on Friday night, in commemoration of the manna that fell double portion Friday. Okay? So it says, Vehechinu et asher yaviu. They have to prepare whatever they want in advance of Shabbat. So it says, if you want the man to be baked, you have to bake it before Shabbat Friday. Make it into loaves, whatever you want. If you want to cook it, you have to cook it. Now, by the way, I can get cute here. It says, asher tofu efu. If they wish to bake it, they should bake it. Vasher tovashle vashelu. If they want to cook it, they cook it. So you know that man could taste like any food in the world, right? Yeah, yeah? Okay. This is cute. Asher tofu efu, it says. What you wish to bake, bake. Tofu. So perhaps man was a form of God's tofu, which, as you know, if you've ever been to I remember in Seattle, in my youth, they had a delicious Chinese Buddhist restaurant under Hashgacha, and they made tofu into everything. It was amazing food. I don't know how the chefs did it, but tofu is remarkable. It can taste like anything you wish. So that's kind of a little bit aside. Tofu, efu. So what's the point of man? It's that it's a prepared food. Please file that away. Man, definition Rashi, it's a type of hachana. It's prepared food, ready to eat, okay? Haman and prepared food. Oh, okay. Now, why is that significant? You know why? It's amazing. You ready? Hold on to your brain splits. In the first chapter of the book of Esther, Megillat Esther, we meet Haman, but we meet him surreptitiously under a pen name. He's referred to Haman, but not as Haman. You know who he's called in the first chapter? Take a guess. Preparation guy. Wow. So in other words, man is prepared food. It's described as mukhan, hachana, prepared food ready to eat, yeah? Haman, the man, is prepared. And Haman himself, we are introduced to him. You know what his name was? His name was Memuchan, Mr. Preparation. He's the seventh and the lowliest of the advisors to Ahasuerus. So let's contextualize. Ahasuerus and Vashti come up with a plan to change the dynamic of the kingdom of Persia. Remember, Vashti, the queen, the nefarious, beautiful character, but internally a rasha, a wicked, enormously wicked person, they conspire to change Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, ancestors, of course, of Vashti, how they ran Babylonia, Babel. And they had this party, 180 days, seven more days for those localites living in the city of Shushan, the capital city. They had moved the capital to Shushan from where apparently it was before, again, to transform the society of the 127 countries and provinces under the jurisdiction of King Ahasuerus. He marries his beautiful Vashti to cement his position as the king, because remember, he's not really a king. He's just Hamolech, the one who inserts himself and becomes the power of the place. What better way for him, Ahasuerus, to firmly show the people, I'm a royal guy, even though I don't have that genetics, because I'm marrying Miss Princess Vashti, who hails from Nebuchadnezzar. We all know Nebuchadnezzar, right? Yeah, okay. So he worked. But then everything was undone at the end of the party, right? Because he's drunk as a skunk. It's the seventh day of the party. The localites are all there. The kings, princes, people he loves. The men are in one section of the palace. Vashti is another section of the palace. And they're having a crazy discussion. Who are the most beautiful women in all the 127 countries, mirror, mirror on the wall? Who is the fairest of them all? And they all come up with their own versions, the drunk kings, the Egyptian women, the Indian women, the Cushi women, because they're all different representations there. Finally, Ahasuerus, very intoxicated. And remember, everything in Purim happens with a little bit of shikar, with a little bit of wine, okay? Be careful when you drink lots of wine. It says, Mishinichnas hayayin yotze hasod. When the wine comes in, the secrets come out, right? You think of the parties, that the Hanukkah parties where the poor guy who's working for the draconian boss has a little too much adult beverage, right? And then decides to tell his boss at the party his real true feelings for the boss. Yikes, okay? I'm sure that has happened many times, so be careful. So what happens at this party? Ahasuerus says, my Persian women are the best and grandest of them all. And my wife Vashti, oh, she's the best. She is the best. And I'll show you all. I will command her to appear tonight wearing her birthday suit, according to the rabbis. And by the way, she was more than willing to defile herself because she was very proud of who she was. It was all a plan, essentially. But it was undone because Vashti gets indignant. Not only does she refuse the message to appear before His Royal Highness Ahasuerus in front of his drunk comrades, she has a bunch of pimples or whatever happens to her. She doesn't want to go. She's not farpitzed. All right? She, whatever it is. Now, what happens? She not only says, I'm not coming. She says, dear messenger boy, Mr. FedEx, and I'm sure the FedEx guy loved this one. She said, take your pen out, take your quill, take my message word for word, please. Tell the king that had he lived in the time of my great-grandfather Nebuchadnezzar, who was a real melech, a real king, he would not have had a gig, he would not have had a job cleaning up the manure in the stables. You got that one? And poor guy, the FedEx guy's thinking, wait a minute, you know. I think there's going to be a time where Caesar kills the messengers for bad ideas. This is not going to work well. So the poor guy has to come back, and he reads word for word Vashti's insult to His Royal Highness Ahasuerus. And of course, Ahasuerus is beyond words, literally and figuratively. And he turns to, of course, who? The Jews. He gets the rabbis together. He says, rabbis, I need your counsel. What should I do to the queen who has disrespected me? No respect at all. What do I do? And they know, the rabbis, we're dead whatever we tell him. If we tell him what he wants to know now, which is off with her head, tomorrow morning when he's no longer drunk, he'll blame it on the Jews. You guys counseled me to kill her. And if we do nothing, they'll say, well, you have no respect, no honor for me that you dare to allow a queen to just trample my thoughts and my wishes? What? So either way, we're doomed. So you know what the rabbis did? The best thing ever. If you have nothing to say, what my uncle Art used to say, better say nothing and to say nothing, but if you open your big mouth, you'll remove all the doubt and prove them right. Say nothing and let people think you're an idiot, because if you open your mouth, you'll prove them correct. You're right. So Uncle Art said it in a not as poignantly as the great Abraham Lincoln. So what happens? Ahasuerus is told by the rabbis, we don't know, Your Royal Highness. We're not sure. Please go get your advisors. So the Megillah tells us in the first chapter, we're only in the first parak, that he asks his 7 paid councilmen to come in. And he says, guys, what do I do? And they're all pretty smart, right? 6 of them beg off, like the rabbis. They're thinking, there's no successful outcome for me if I advise the king at this point. So they all like, we don't know, Your Royal Highness. And at the back of the room, the guy with the triangle hat gets up. But he's not called Haman. He's called Memuchan. Mr. Memuchan. He's the 7th and least of the 7. He's the less of the choshev guy. Like, he has nothing. He's inconsequential at this moment. And then he comes up famously and says, not only has Vashti insulted you, Your Royal Highness, but every man in the entire kingdoms of Ahasuerus, Your Royal Highness, off with their head, and you better send out a letter declaring male supremacy over the women. Ahasuerus buys into it. He says, yes, Memuchan. And he elevates Memuchan to the position as basically the prime minister, the viceroy of his kingdom. He buys in lock, stock, and barrel, as they say. He's right there with Achashverosh and Memuchan, Haman and he become pals. So the rabbis in the Gemara and the Talmud say, wait a minute, this is Haman? Well, why don't you just tell us he's Haman? Why use a subterfuge? He's Mr. Preparation, Memuchan. Why is he called Haman? You know why? He's Muchan Lefuranut. Muchan Lefuranus. He is destined, prepared to take a fall. He's going to die in the end. He's going to prepare really well, then in the end he will be blown up. Wow. So let's just step back now. Ready? Or let's get our minds wavering here. So here you have a food called man. Haman, the manna. And we described how the food is the source for Jewish laws regarding preparation for Shabbat and the holidays. Yeah? And the food is actually called man because it's a prepared type of food, ready to eat. And then you have Haman, who is called Mr. Prepared by Mordechai and Esther when they authored the Megillah Esther, when they wrote down the Megillah. He's Memuchan, not Haman, but yet he's Mr. Preparation. And he's prepared to take a fall. So what does all this mean? Okay, before I unpackage it all for you, ready? This is the best. What Jewish day did Haman finally get his comeuppance? Anybody know? It's a trivia question. I'll give you a hint. It's the second day of Passover, Tet Zion Nisan. How do we know this? Because we know that Esther famously fasted. The fast was declared. It was Passover. And there's a very big question. How do you fast on Passover? And or Yotzeh, how do you fulfill your mitzvah of Manischewitz matzah? Or shatz or matzah. So the Gemara discusses like what they would have done, how much they could eat, still be considered fasting, okay? It was Passover. Everyone gets very confused because we think of Adar, right, when Purim is, but the letter, the edict, destroying the Jewish people wasn't to go into effect for 11 months. So that was Adar of the next year. This is Passover time. And that's when Esther goes on Passover. She goes inside the inner sanctum of the king, right? He lifts up his scepter. Esther, what do you want? I want to throw a party. And then there's a second party, right? You know the story. Haman is hanged. He gets his comeuppance and his end on the second day of Passover, Tet Zayin Nisan. Ready? You're all sitting down, right? Yeah. Okay. Do you want to know what day, and we know exactly what it is, it's written down in the Torah, what day did the manna bread from heaven, what was its last day before it stopped falling? Tet Zayin Nisan, the 60th day of Nisan. So the manna died, so to speak. It had its end on the 16th day of Nisan. Haman comes to an end, Haman, on the exact same day. I mean, insane, right? Crazy. What are we supposed to get from this idea of Haman, man, preparation? Okay? So let me now, for the next 5 minutes, unpackage this, and we're going to call it a night. Ready? Haman did something very crazy. I'm sure everyone here who reads the Megillah, probably you scratch your head a little bit and say, you know, I don't understand. I could do better. Okay. Haman is given the offer of a lifetime. He thinks. He bursts in the middle of the night. Achashverosh can't sleep. And Haman's outside waiting with bated foul breath to get permission to hang Mordechai, correct? And Achashverosh has the chronicles read, and he just now discovered that all those years ago, the assassination plot of Bigson Esarish, it was Mordechai who overheard the plot and reported it and saved the king's life, but he never rewarded him, right? And Haman's outside making a little noise out there in the chutzner in the garden, and he says, who's out there? Because he's a little paranoid, you know, people trying to kill him now. So they bring Haman in. It's like 3 a.m. And I'm sure Achashverosh is looking at him and say, why are you lurking up in my courtyard at 3 a.m.? Because he's waiting to get permission to kill Mordechai, right? And what did the king just discover? Who's his one true friend in the world? Mordechai! But someone falsified the records, the chronicles of the king. You know who did that? Haman. But unbeknownst to Haman, there were two sets of chronicles. One that he falsified, giving himself credit for undermining Bigson Esarish's assassination plot. But then there was a second set of records that they didn't touch, that now, for the first time ever, Achashverosh has them read because he can't sleep. Incredible. So he turns to Haman, does Achashverosh. Haman, He says, you know what? I'm glad you're here. Welcome, welcome. Welcome. It's only 3:30 a.m. Wow. Okay. I need your advice here. Remember, he's the great council guy. He did a great job with Vashti. Okay? And he says, Haman, what do I do for the man that I love so much and I want to honor over and above everything else? What do I do? Right? Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not asking for a stupid horse and a crown and a robe to be walked around and say, oh, he's the best. You know, I'm sorry. I want cryptocurrency. Okay? Right? I want Apple shares. I want gold up the wazoo, whatever that wazoo is. All right? I want real stuff. You want a horse and a king's robe and a crown? This, now you might say, but Rabbi, come on. Haman already had all the money he needed. He didn't. Money was objectively meaningless to him. He wanted honor. And you're right. That's the simple explanation. Okay? But now I'm going to blow your mind with another explanation. There is a midrash, a section of oral Torah, that tells us the world operates according to the following principle. Ready? You have a horse and you have a rider. God, ostensibly, is riding the horse and directing the horse where to go. Lamaha olam doma. That's what the Midrash asks. What is the world like? A horse and a rider. Now you might think, says the Midrash, that because the horse is so magnificent and it's big and it's beautiful and strong, that the horse is kind of in charge. You'd be wrong. The one riding the horse directs the horse, not the other way around. So who's the only person in human history who thought that they could ride the king's horse? Haman. He didn't just ask for a horse. He didn't say, well, I want secretariat. He said, HaMelech, that the king rides on. That's the horse I want. You know what the rabbis say? Whenever it doesn't mention Achashverosh's name by name, it's a veiled reference to the king. He's asking for God's horse. Why would that be? You see, he is Mr. Memuchan, remember? He's Man. He's the prepared guy. So he believes that he can take all of his prep that he did. And by the way, the Talmud says, nobody in human history prepared like Haman did. Every detail, every nuance spoken for. So he believed that if you put out energy, massive, copious amounts of energy, that he could take and direct that energy the way he, Haman, the human being, wanted. And what did he find out? He didn't get to ride the horse, did he? Mordechai, God, rode the horse. Instead, Haman went in front and got a whole bunch of poop on his head from his own daughter. That's a midrash. I won't go into that. So Haman believed, that's true. Haman believed that he could ride the horse. So what does that mean? Here's an incredible thing. How do we quantify energy in our world? You know one of the ways? And it's never made any sense to me because I didn't. Horsepower. Thank you, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe. Horsepower. Now in Europe, they don't do it. They use kilowatts. So when you buy a car in Europe, you get to say, well, my new Ferrari has, 650 kilowatts. Well, good luck. But it's not as sexy and as meaningful as someone says to you, oh my gosh, right, Jeff? I have 500 horsepower under the hood. You're like, yeah. Every guy, every woman who's into racing or into sports cars, right? I got a Corvette and I got 545 brake horsepower, right? And it's like machismo. Wow, right? You ever think about this? We don't live in that society anymore. How many people here, maybe Rebecca Moshe Cook, could do the arithmetic on what actually horsepower means, how you define energy by horsepower, not kilowatts. The Europeans, in this only way, it's the only thing they have better than us, they define it in a better way. It's more objectively a real thing. Whereas horsepower is definitely not really knowable to the average human being. But think about it. In the delicious model, Haman puts out prodigious amounts of horsepower. Everything. The day, the lottery, the date, the selection, every little thing. I'm going to kill Mordechai and the Jews. He's putting out hundreds of brake horsepower, and he believes that he'll drive the horse. He'll drive the Corvette. He'll drive the Ferrari, because it's a horse, the prancing horse. He's going to drive that Ferrari Enzo. And guess what he discovered? Sorry. God said to Haman, guess what, Mr. Haman? Bravo. Yashakayach. What a great job. You
produced all the energy of the world, and you're going to find out, you loser, that at the end of the day, you're going for a ride. You're a passenger. You're not riding and directing the horse. I am, God says, thank you. Yashakoa. So most deliciously. I'll just set it up. You ready? Haman is so intent on destroying Mordecai, he can't wait 11 months till the letter goes into effect and the genocide is committed against everyone. No, no, no. He's got to get Mordecai now. I want him dead, right? A horse's head, sorry, in the bed. You know, I want him dead right now. Right? He's the godfather. I want him dead, dead, deader. All right, he can't wait. So he goes home to his family, and they come up with the brilliant idea, what? To build a very tall gallows. Oh, my gosh. Who gets to have a swinging good time on those gallows? Haman! He builds the gallows for himself. So that's just the most powerful illustration of how he, Mr. Memuchan, the prepared guy, remember the man, Mr. Preparation, this is what the Talmud means. He's prepared for a fall. Because whatever he does, God will utilize his prodigious horsepower energy that he's put into the game. And he's going to say, Yashakoa, I'm going to use all your input, Haman, but not exactly in the way that you envision. And that's brought out so magically with Haman, Haman, the mana, preparation. So where does that leave us? Leaves us the following. We can't possibly know how our prayers, how our mitzvot, how our involvement in this world, our commandments, our good deeds, we don't know how they're going to shape ourselves, our neighbors, our friends, our world. That's up to God. Our job is simply to put out the energy and let the master of the world decide where our prayers are going to go, where our tears are going to be used, about who needs our healing, who needs this. That's not up for human knowledge. It's unknowable. All we can do is hope and pray, keep doing what we're doing, keep pushing it forth, and know that at the end of the day, God wins, and God has a plan for us. And that's the significance and beauty of Purim and the Megillah takeaway, that at the end of the day, LaYehudim haisa ora v'simcha v'sason v'ikar, that God is going to do something precious, magical. There'll be light, joy, gladness for the Jewish people. B'mehra, b'yameinu, during these dark times, may it happen very soon. Good evening, everyone.